You are now checked in to Stand Up New York Labs. Oh, yeah. Baby, 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 oh. Fuck it! Fuck it! Fuck it! Fucking hostile!
This is the Real Ass Podcast. Here's your host, Louis J. Gomez.
Oh, shit. Oh, that's right, Gomites. You've tuned in for another Real Ass edition of the Real Ass Podcast. The Real Ass Podcast, not only on Stand Up New York Labs, but I'll say on the planet Earth. I will fucking own it. I'll say right now, the realest podcast on the planet Earth. I'm your host, Louis J. Gomez, Puerto Rican rattlesnake, real ass dude, Howard Stern of MMA Radio himself. I am here live for you people. I know. You can barely contain yourselves. Here's the one thing I know about the Real Ass fans, that they're all standing and applauding right now. I get a standing ovation every time I start one of my podcasts. That's how the Real Ass fans salute me. And I'm actually pumped about today's show. I know I say that every week, but this is the first time that I truly genuinely mean it, okay? We got an amazing show. First of all, new thing, I'm getting rid of the intro. No more intro for the show, okay? This is it. We have the guests in studio. We have my co-host in studio. I'm not doing a whole big fucking crazy intro anymore. It's just unnecessary. You know what it is? We end up starting to get into a conversation with the co-host, and then we bring in the guests, and it kind of ruins the rhythm. So it's almost two separate shows. So I feel like it's just, we're not doing it that way anymore. We're going to start the show off with the guests in studio. Today's co-host, because Zach Amico, the international superstar Zach Amico, is still up in Buffalo right now filming an A-list movie with some horror movie, I think. So he's not back, but in his place, very large shoes to fill, very large clown-sized juggalo-type shoes to fill, one Mr. Rob Bernstein. Robbie Bernstein, how are you today?
Very good. Thanks for having me, Louis.
All right. You already failed your first test. I wanted you to come in with some heat, with some fire. But you really just...
Am I supposed to be slinging it already?
I figured you'd just throw something a little bit more excited. Okay. I didn't think you would be that passive.
All right, I'll step it up. Okay. Starting from here. You want to do it again?
One more time. All right, guys. We got... You know, we need to give you... Maybe we need to give you a nickname. What would your nickname be? Super Jew.
Super Jew.
Ladies and gentlemen, give it up for my co-host, the Super Jew, Robbie Bernstein.
Thank you for having me. I'm very excited.
Nice. There we go. That was a little bit more like Hitler, but it's okay.
It's kind of like Arnold Schwarzenegger. A little. Thank you for having me. I'm super excited to be a Jew.
Today's guest, hold on, let me put his music on. Today's guest, very good friend of mine. I would say my best friend. My best friend, very hilarious comedian. Also another podcaster on Stand Up New York Labs. Political aficionado, I would say political expert, Dave Smith. Song. I never realized what this song was about, and now I'm looking at the lyrics.
Serious.
And looking at these images.
The National Guard murdering a bunch of children.
Yeah, man. Look, beyond that, you're picking this. Did you see that thing that was in the news recently? Urban Outfitters put out a Kent State shirt.
Horrible. Yeah.
Did you see?
They say it was unintentional, though. Like, they weren't trying to make a political statement. It was just like, it was just, you know, for the college. And then it happened to be that color of blood.
Yeah, I guess Urban Outfitters made a replica college shirt.
They were like, wait, did a thing happen at Kent State with blood? And we're just celebrating the college here.
There was red splatter marks across the Kent State logo.
and then people were up in arms about that. But I guess they denied it. They said it had nothing to do with it. It was just a coincidence.
Right.
But yeah, Dave Smith, why this song? Why'd you choose this song?
I don't know. I don't know what it is. It's just something like, kind of like you said, like an anti-war song that I like, and then this just kind of came to mind. I don't know if this is exactly an anti-war song, but those kids were protesting a war. That's why they got killed. I love this song. Great tune.
Yeah, man, it's a really good tune. And you know, look, I guess it kind of relates now. We're going through a lot of shit. We're gonna have a heavy show today, guys. First of all, if you guys, hopefully you guys are tweeting us questions. Yeah, they're coming through already. I we're gonna talk a lot about what's going on in the Middle East today. What's going on with ISIS? Should we be afraid? Should the Gomites be living in fear? Or is this just a bunch of hype? I don't know. We're going to talk about that today. I'm glad to I have the
show. Or should they just be living in shame? As we're all more comfortable with.
Really, Gomites are legitimately the closest thing to Juggalos in the comedy world.
I didn't think... No one ever thought there could be anything beneath Juggalo. But
that's
it turns
not true.
Out.
Gomites are greater than Juggalos. Everyone knows that. No, I'm happy to have you on the show today, Dave. Here's the thing.
We so rarely get a chance to podcast together.
me and Dave Smith, we do the Hammer Fisting podcast together. We do Legion of Skanks together. We do a lot of podcasts
together. But
we don't really ever get a chance to sit down and have just a serious conversation about anything but MMA. Legion
record
of Skanks.
It, yeah. We should say.
Legion of Skanks, we just come in and we just get fucked up and tell crazy, stupid stories. And I'm actually really pumped to have you on.
Carry that fucking Jay Oakerson on our shoulders.
You were
that talentless. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
You were on the demo episode of the Real Ass Podcast.
I'm the reason why this thing got picked up by Stand Up Labs. It was actually, I mean, it probably wouldn't have been here if I had to fight for it. But anyway,
Dave Smith just started his own political web series. I'm directing and producing it.
You're doing an excellent job, by the way.
That's what you did last week. The topic was arming Syrian rebels, and I want to get into that stuff. And
Check it out. Dave Smith on arming Syrian rebels.
The web series is called Dave Smith On.
I want some credit for being crew. I carried the mics. Did a lot of hard
episode
work today.
Episode 2, a lot of the essence of what episode 2 is was created by Rob Bernstein.
That's right.
I should say that.
So, Dave, you started this political web series.
Yes, sir.
You're one of the only, in my opinion, one of the only comics working that makes political comedy digestible. I think that a lot of the times when guys are doing political comedy, the idea is to get your agenda across and then try to write jokes around the agenda.
Right.
And I think the way you approach it, and I think the way you know, it's kind of the your DNA and the way you kind of learned how to do comedy was to come out and kill first, and then you kind of figured out a way to slip in the points that you want to make within the structure of these really, really funny jokes.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think a lot of that's just like kind of like the people who I looked up to in stand-up comedy or like look up to, like we're always like really the funny guys, you know, like that's kind of like what I always wanted to be. I don't know, I think like when I'm just talking or podcasting or something like that, like I'm part of the problem. I don't know if that's like super digestible. Like I really just give you my philosophy, but like I think that's the job of stand-up comedy is to like be funny. That's the point. It's, I mean, if you're just up there, I think with too many of these guys, it's like if you're just up there, like, you're not a professor of, you know what I mean, like, history or like, a political science professor or something like that. You're a stand-up comedian. If I start just being a poli-sci teacher, then there's probably someone a lot more qualified to do this. Like, but if I'm being funny, then that's kind of my unique qualification. Like, that's what I bring to it. So, I don't know.
Yeah, now, look, little known, if you guys don't know about my and Dave's relationship, I will personally take credit.
We fuck.
I have sex with Dave in his butt, and he loves it. No, I will take credit for Dave Smith doing comedy. Me and Dave were roommates years ago. I started doing comedy first.
Lewis, I found he was on the streets when I found him.
And
I brought him into my home.
I convinced Dave, after over a year of trying and pushing, I said, Dave, you're literally one of the funniest fucking people I've ever met in my entire life. You need
Lewis
to go.
Lewis was raised by wolves, had met maybe 3 people at this point. So.
They were very funny wolves, though.
They were.
Whose phone is that?
Oh, maybe Jessica's? Or is that yours, Rob?
Robbie Bernstein fucking up the show again. No, yeah, I convinced Dave to do comedy. Let me ask you, dude, because we've never really talked about this on a podcast. I regret it. What stopped you from doing comedy? What was it? Why didn't you just immediately jump right in?
What do you mean?
Because look, here's the thing, dude. It literally took me probably over a year to convince you just from the idea of saying, "Hey, I kind of want to do it. I'm thinking about doing it." I think you ended up doing an open mic once, and then you just said, "Fuck it, I'm not doing this again for a little while." But what was keeping you from getting on stage?
Well, I mean, I'm not really by nature like a jump in head first guy. I think I am more of a kind of like size it up. Kind of like I'm fairly hesitant like in that stuff, and I don't know, I just had like a kind of weird mentality at the time. Do you remember, I always say this because I think it's just interesting, like the mentality before doing comedy to understanding what it actually is, but my attitude was like I was almost like, if you remember when you were like, you got to do this, I'd be like, dude, I'm going to I just got to like sit down and like work out the perfect set in my head, and then I'll go do stand-up comedy and I'll already have like a great set. I just really got to like think it through perfectly. And I can like but of course that's not how it works. You have to just go on stage and kind of get used to just being on stage.
I was gonna say, I frequently run into people who are kind of hanging out at shows and they want to start doing comedy. They're always telling me, oh, I'm writing, and I always tell them, whatever you're writing is worthless. You're gonna have to get up and realize, oh, this was worthless. I have to actually figure out how to do this on stage.
Yeah, you'll never write even a good joke, a good stand-up joke,
no,
before you get up on stage and try it out, because it's such a nuanced thing that it's like, you know, even like I wrote down a joke the other day in my phone. I read it to you, Dave. You're like, oh, that's really funny. You know, you think about it, meeting a girl who lost 150 pounds. But I'm trying it on stage, and no, it's not getting big laughs. It's a funny idea, but it's the way you say it. It's the words that I'm deciding to use, the pauses that I take in the joke, or, you know, putting in one word and taking out another word makes such a big difference that it takes trial and error over and over and over again just to see what kind of works. And this is after nearly 10 years of experience of doing comedy.
Right.
It's still that process. When you've never gotten on stage before,
it's a whole different thing. At that point, when you're at the beginning, it's just about, literally the first year of comedy is just about being comfortable speaking into a microphone in front of a group of people. Like, that's what it's all about. It's just like getting comfortable with, I'm going up on stage and speaking to all of you people. It's really just getting used to that dynamic is a very hard thing. You know, you'll be in it for like a month and you get up like once a week at the same place and you feel like, okay, I've got it. I'm used to like talking to people. And then all of a sudden you go to some other place you haven't been yet and you're like, what? The stage is in a different place and the light's in a different place. And then that freaks you out. Getting to a place where you are, where you can just go up in front of any group of people and speak into a microphone and be comfortable, takes a while, man. Like, that's...
Well, I think it's like comedy is this, you know, or being funny is, I mean, it's such a weird thing. It's not even a skill. It's like a feeling. It's a trait. You know what I'm saying? And it's like, if you're not comfortable, that trait is like numbed down. You know, it's like podcasting. We weren't comfortable. If you listen to the first Hammer Fisting podcast, I wasn't comfortable sitting in a room.
Well, you're 100 pounds overweight.
Talking to, breathing. I had sleep apnea. It was really hot. But I wasn't comfortable talking into an MP3 recorder and just expressing my ideas. So I came off
as... You were about
to
say mic, but then you realized we didn't have mics in the beginning.
It was just a fucking MP3 recorder in the center of the room.
Yeah, no one's comfortable talking into an MP3 recorder. They're like, why can't you afford a mic to plug into that thing?
But you get what I'm saying. It's like, it's all about being in a state where you're comfortable. And it's almost like, you know, in school, you know, you always end up being really, really funny. Or even if you're not a class clown type, the funny kids always ended up being really, really funny with their friends. You know, it's like Rob Bernstein, you're not like a class clown type, but you're really funny around us. You know what I'm saying? Maybe that's not true either.
No.
But, you know, you really should quit comedy. The more I'm talking about this, the more I'm describing Rob Bernstein.
Is this a comedy intervention? Is that why I was brought on? this whole thing, oh, we're going to talk about ISIS. We're going to interview Dave. And then it was...
We haven't been recording. Yeah, this is all even on, Dave. Just for us.
But, I mean, it really is about a level of comfort. And I think that in the beginning, this is why a lot of people never even get into comedy that want to do it. It's they never feel comfortable enough to get up on stage for that first time. I guess it's a really terrifying thing. But once you do it one time, then it becomes super addictive.
I think probably part of what kept you was you were actually watching real comedy shows.
Yeah.
I think what's nice about starting with open mics is you go to your first open mic and people are so horrible, you kind of get an ego. Well, at least I'm better than that guy.
Yeah.
And that gets you on to the stage to do
sure.
it.
Sure. But, you know, comedy is a very interesting thing. It really, it's a weird kind of psychological test. It kind of, it brings out all your narcissism issues and ego issues, and like you kind of you get very delusional. Like it, there's something about it's like a drug making people laugh, so you feel like you're a lot better when you're like a month into comedy than you are. And it's kind of necessary because you wouldn't stick with it unless you felt like you're a little bit better than you are. But then you get to a point where you're like a year and a half in comedy and you're like, I've got some jokes that do well. I feel really good about this doing well. And you're like, yeah, I'm getting good. I'm going to be amazing by the time I'm like 5 years, at, you know, and then you get like 3-4 years in and you're like, oh, that was all a bunch of horse shit. I got to start over from scratch. It's kind of this process of like thinking you're further than you are, then getting knocked back, feeling like you're further behind than you are, then feeling like a comic's sense of identity and sense of self-worth is never in line with where it should be. They're always way narcissistic or way self-deprecating. Like, right. it's never evens out.
It's a really inspirational comedy talk we got going on here.
No, dude, you're going to do pretty good before you eventually blow your brains out in like 10, 15 years. You'll get like a couple TV things before that.
Rob, how did you start, Rob? I never even talked to you about this. How did you get the idea to do comedy?
I saw it when I was 18. I think I saw a show at the...
Get out of the house and go tell some jokes or something.
No, I saw a show at the Improv, and I thought it was just the coolest thing I'd ever seen. I also felt like, oh, I could do that. But then...
Who was it that you saw?
So I know Lisa Lampanelli closed out the show.
It's where you find out Rob Bernstein, his first few months of comedy, was just doing fat girl, black guys fuck me jokes.
Hey, black guy, I'd fuck you. I'd fuck you right in your face, black guy. I'll tell you that much. I don't really get it.
The guy, I can't remember his name, the guy from Crank Anchors who did the, I've got mail, yay.
Fucking
Jim. You know, Jim Florentine was on the show. Yeah. I don't remember who else was on the show.
Do you remember how big that thing was, that character?
I loved it. I thought it was so cool to see the guy on stage because I was a big Crank Anchors fan.
Did you see the one that Kevin Nealon did where he just kept saying preface? I don't know why I thought that was just like the funniest thing I've ever heard. like he just called the guy and just kept saying preface. Like he was like he was like called up a place to complain or something like that. And he's like, now, sir, I have a complaint. But before I complain, let me just preface this complaint by saying that I am a long member. I always come to your set. And if I could just preface my preface by saying, like, he just kept prefacing. Like, I thought that's the great phone call. It's like you just get to like the eighth preface and they're like, all right. Dude.
I thought the best one they did was with Tracy Morgan calling up the golf place for tea time.
That was great. Well, the guy.
No, this is Spoon.
I loved Spoon. Was great. I loved my favorite. I love crank phone calls. I'm just like a sucker for that.
You know, John Moses just started a prank phone call podcast.
Yes, yeah, I've actually talked to him about that. Yeah, I did it.
I did it. I guess last week it was pretty funny, dude. I had to call up a hypnotist, and I had to convince him that I was going to bring a girl in and I wanted him to hypnotize her to have sex with me. And I kept him on the phone for 15 minutes and literally we're in the process of planning a rape. Like at one point it got to the point where he's like, okay, well, you know, we'd have to meet her in my office. Cause I said, well, can we just meet her at a Starbucks? She doesn't know we're going to like do this. Dude, this guy got so into it. So then finally this would set him off.
What was the most violent thing you floated?
Yeah, he's like, well, maybe you should come in first alone. And I was like, listen, doc, I'm not into that stuff. And that made him flip out. Like he lost his mind on me.
What did he say?
That I'd suggest that he was trying to do like gay shit. He got mad. Listen to the podcast, guys. Go listen the PCP podcast, Prank Call Podcast. Very funny. On Stand Up New York Labs.
I think my favorite guy on Crank Anchors was the old rich guy that double it.
I don't remember.
He'd always be, he would just like call the place. And he'd be like, you know, like whatever. It'd be like a place that rents out canoes or something. And he'd be like, I'm looking to rent out your finest canoe. And they'd be like, okay, sir, our finest canoe is like this and that. And he goes, now, what does it cost? And they're like, well, for a 1 week standard rental, you know, it's $399. And he'd be like, can you do me a favor? Can you take that price and double it? He goes, I'm a very wealthy man. Like, play this, I'm a rich guy. And that would always be his thing. And they'd be like, sir, we can't double the price. Like, that's our price. He goes, okay, do me a favor. Double it. and the way the puppet moved was hilarious.
You're 18, you're in California, you went to the Improv, mm-hmm. You saw a show, and you were like, I'm better than Jim Florentine. You said that in your head.
No, I did not say that.
Immediately
in my head.
You said, all right,
no,
Lisa
Lampanelli,
Jim Florentine.
That retard can get on stage and spit out that nonsense.
It's so funny
because
that's like, you really, in a weird way, it is an insulting thing.
I don't know if I agree with that. Well, you're saying you think
no,
you,
that wasn't.
I think it's inspiring.
It's the first time you go to a comedy show and you see somebody on stage and you go, I'm looking at what they're doing. You go, oh, I can do that. In a weird way, you should go, No, I cannot do that. When I saw Eddie Murphy for the first time, okay, and this is like the when I was a kid, the biggest comedian in the world and the guy who I saw as being the best in the world. When I saw Eddie Murphy come out in that fucking red suit and you know, the band was playing and then he was fucking, it was bigger than life, it was larger than life. I like in my head, I was like, okay, I would never even know step one how to do that. I could never do that.
Yeah, but a lot of that's being a kid and seeing someone famous. When you're a kid and you see someone famous, it's like, yeah, there's no way they could be that. I'm saying when I first started doing comedy or when I first started hanging around comedy and I saw guys like Metzger and like Big J and like, you know, whoever, like Nate and guys like that who were just like, I just thought what they were doing was so awesome. I was like, oh, that's fucking really, these guys are like really good comics. Like doing high, and I did kind of have a thing like, I was like, I think it was just a belief in myself. I was like, I think I can do that. I think like I could get to that. But I don't know if there's necessarily, I don't think there was anything insulting in it being like, oh yeah, I mean, I can do that. Like I thought it was high level shit, but I was like, I think I can get there. It's a little bit different. Yeah, when you see someone famous as a kid, of course you'd never think like, that's just what a famous person does. No,
but I think somebody should be a good comic. I'm insulted when somebody comes up to me after a show and says, hey, you were really funny up there. That was great. It's like, I've been thinking about doing comedy. You know, I want to get on stage. I saw you. Now I want to go do it. A little piece of me goes like, okay, well, does this not seem like a skill to you that you would need to have? You know, I don't know. And look, I'm not truly genuinely insulted, but it is kind of a weird thing. There's just such an influx of comedians. There's thousands of comics right now in New York. It's like, no, not everybody is funny. One out of 50 kids in school were funny. Those are the kids who should go do a comedy. And I think too many people see comedians. And maybe it's just because it's the nature of the game.
I agree with you in general. I almost think that's a big problem just like with our generation. It's like, hey, only funny people should be in comedy. Only smart people should be in fucking college. Only people who can sing should go out for American Idol. You know what I'm saying? But we do kind of live in this world where that everyone just wants to be. It's kind of like the participation trophy generation reaping what was sown. Like everyone just thinks they're talented because they were told they were great as a kid.
So to clarify my comment, I had similar feelings like being at a rock concert, even art museum, looking and going, wow, this is the coolest thing in the world. But I knew I had no artistic talent. I could draw my whole life. I would never get anywhere. Or I could play guitar forever, would never get anywhere. When I watched the comedy show, I was like, oh, I'm a funny person. This is something I could work on.
I get that.
So when I said, when I was saying, oh, I could do that, I wasn't saying I could do it immediately at their level. I'll also say I just always loved like talk radio. I grew up with Howard Stern and then Opie and Anthony. And I always loved comedy movies. Not so much, I didn't watch
You grew up with Howard Stern? You guys are the same age?
No, fair enough. In high school, we used to listen to Howard Stern every morning. I loved it. Yeah. So I guess when I started this, I was just really interested in working like in television and in comedy. And with the stand-up, you could just start, you could get up and you could do it. And then I just kind of fell in love with this over anything else.
It's such a weird thing because it does really suck in the beginning. And it's like, you know, while you're in it, it's kind of funny. It doesn't really feel like it that bad. It's this weird trick. It's almost like a trick of nature. You know, it's like high school. It's like a woman forgetting that the pain of labor hurts. There's this weird thing.
Or it's like high school. If you had to go back, you'd kill yourself day one. But at the time, somehow you just lived through this.
For me, in the early days of doing stand-up, I never really had much of a social life. And I used to just get hammered every night doing it. So I think that part of the appeal was just kind of being out of my house and drinking.
Well, I got to say, dude, I feel like you've fucking like grown a lot or like opened up a lot like since I've known you. I've only really we've only known each other for, I guess, a little over a year, like a year and a few months. And we've become like kind of tight friends over the last year. And I do feel like you've kind of like, as you've like kind of found your voice in comedy a little bit more, not to, obviously you haven't been doing it for that long. You have a lot of developing to like still do, but I do feel like you've opened up a lot as a person. Like, even just being comfortable, like you said, just like, you were a guy who was almost like a little like unconfident of your own like game and shit like that. And now you're just like, you'll just like throw it at bitches like nothing. You're just like, whatever, man. I'm fucking...
Well, Robbie's learned...
Robbie's the amount of pussy he's gotten in his life since I've known you in
Robbie's
this last
learned
year.
To disconnect from the word no. And I think it served him well both in
you
comedy...
You gotta watch the rapey things that you say, man. It really just doesn't even get out.
That's
out.
Right, women
you
say
just
no,
disconnect
I just...
from no, man. I don't even hear no. You say no, I'm just powering right through that now. What? Sorry.
No, but it's in sales. It's in... Look, everything is sales.
No, I'm busting balls. You're absolutely right.
Doing comedy is sales. Getting pussy is sales. That's all it is. Okay, you're selling yourself in both of these.
Believing
cases.
In yourself and being
so
willing to have the confidence.
So when you disconnect from the word no, and you don't let it affect you, you just go, all right, well, now I'm just going to go out and play these numbers. Robbie goes, all right, doesn't it hurt my feelings if 9 women in a row say no, they don't want to fuck me? Because if 1 out of every 10 women say they want to fuck me, all I got to do is ask 10 women and I'm going to get some pussy. And that's kind of the same thing with comedy. You develop this thicker skin where it's kind of funny because it almost self-pleased itself, because in the beginning there are no opportunities to present it to you because there almost shouldn't be. You know what I'm saying? And then slowly but surely you start getting these no's, but as you're getting better, you know, and this is why it's a very rare thing. You get guys that are super young in comedy that start getting stuff, and that it's almost like a very special thing. You watch people like, you know, Michael Che now, who's been doing comedy for like 4 or 5 years, and he's going to be the biggest fucking comic in the world because he got SNL. You know what I'm saying? But that is a very, very rare thing. You know, in the beginning, it's like I almost feel like you have to slowly but surely kind of build up a thick skin. You know, and for me, it's just nothing but nose. It's been fucking
8 years of nose, 10 years of nose.
Jesus Christ!
I'm sorry, right. Dude, I didn't even hear what you said. I was just thinking the word no.
No,
I'm here talking to think no, no.
So look, all right, Dave, you started off in comedy, dude. You weren't really a political guy for a while.
Not at all.
You weren't even like. You always were a smart dude. You were always interested in kind of like learning and growing in that way.
I was always, I'll tell you what I was always, was a very, I was always very philosophically interested. I was always just kind of interested in something that was interesting. Like whatever it would be, like a deep conversation or what does this mean or something like that. But I was a horrible student, didn't give a shit about politics at all. Like none, I didn't like really read for pleasure at all.
What was it that kind of like made you turn a corner and get interested in politics? So it was around the Obama election that you really right. started to.
So I guess it was like, I mean, I guess like kind of, which is, I guess not very, not untypical, but I guess 9/11 to some degree did kind of like get me a little more interested. Things just seemed a little bit more important. And I think the first memory I have of really giving a shit about politics was when George W. Bush came to New York after 9/11. I mean, I was a city kid, you know, I was here for all that shit. And he came to 9/11, that famous moment with the megaphone. Where he just, it was like the brilliance of his stupidity just for that perfect line where he was like, the people of New York, I just want you to know Washington feels your pain. And he goes, and pretty soon the people who knocked down this building, they're going to feel your pain too. And that like elicited something in me. Like I was like, yes, let's go get these motherfuckers. Like we're New York, we're the biggest bad. And I was just really with him. And then I remember there was this press conference where he got at, you know, you remember at the beginning, it was like, we're going to get Osama bin Laden, like dead or alive. Like that was the thing. And then it was like 6-7 months later, they asked him at this press conference. They were like, hey, what's going on with Osama bin Laden? And he was like, honestly, I don't even really care if we get him or not. I remember that really bothered me. I was like, yeah, fuck you. Like you came here. And then as Bush admitted, I just kind of hated Bush. I didn't really give a fuck about politics, but I was just like, this guy Bush sucks. He lied us into war. This guy's clearly full of shit. And then, so I got kind of into the idea of like this Obama guy, or just the idea of like the Democrats winning. Like,
sorry, I like a little music bit of Dead or Alive with Bon Jovi while you talk about this.
I like how Dave's intellectual pursuit sounded like you were just describing being a stoner. Like, I'm a bad student, philosophical. 9/11 comes around, Bush is talking like, hey, man, I don't believe this guy.
Yeah, but that is where it all started. So I got kind of into the, you know, this, I just wanted kind of a Democrat to win. At first I was kind of like, oh, we'll have maybe Hillary Clinton or Edwards or any of these guys would be fine. Let's get the other team. Just kind of a knee jerk, like this team's wrong, so let's get the other team in.
Dave is sexy as shit with Bon Jovi playing.
It really, it does.
This is changing everything. I can't even listen to you. I'm just getting turned on.
So, all right.
But so in the course of that election, so I started, my curiosity got piqued a little in 2008. And then, randomly, I owe all of it, literally everything, just came from the fact that Ron Paul happened to be in the Republican presidential debate, and I'm watching the debate, and I just saw this little shriveled up skinny old grandpa just fucking nailing it. And like, dude, if you go like YouTube, Ron Paul 2008 presidential debate or GOP debate, the stuff he was taking on Giuliani and taking on, saying, you know, if you remember, the GOP was still stuff like, they hate us because we're free. You know, if you're not with us, you're with them. We have to fight them over there so we don't fight them over here. And Ron Paul just came out and he was like, hey guys, they don't hate us because we're free or we have women in the workplace. They hate us because we've been bombing them for decades. We've been propping up dictatorships and covertly overthrowing elected governments. And he just like, and he just got me interested. And I still didn't get it. I still voted for Obama in that term, like, because I didn't get it. But he just made me want to learn a little bit more. And little by little, I just learned more and more about him. And then it just kind of snowballed.
All right. So Tom, for the people that are listening, because most people don't even fucking know, dude. People are so ignorant. What is libertarianism? Like, how would you define it? Because to me and to the people that don't really follow politics or know, it almost seems like when I first heard of what libertarianism was, I was like, it seems like hippie conservatives. That's the way I describe it. It's like people, they're right wingers, but they're kind of hippies, and they have like this just different way of thinking on the right, though. That's kind of the way that I saw it.
Right. Well, I think, you know, because of Ron Paul being a Republican and kind of a Christian conservative guy, and he's kind of the godfather of this like modern libertarian movement. I think that's kind of why libertarianism is placed on the right, because it's really no more right or left. And a lot of the great classical liberal heroes or libertarian heroes have been on the left. But to me, libertarianism is just, it's just the philosophy of freedom. It's just the idea that adults have the right to do what they want to do. You're free to do what you want to do as long as you don't infringe on anyone else's freedom. And that's like half of it. And the other idea is the idea of property rights. The idea that you have a right to own what you want to do. That's kind of an extension of your body's freedom.
So I would say the harsher criticism of libertarianism, this is not my belief, is that when people would say, hey, well, don't you care about the poor people, or don't you want to offer health care, or what are we going to do if there's no police force? What are we going to do if government's not making roads?
Right. So, right, and I'm not against anyone doing any of that shit, but it's what libertarians have a problem with is the force involved, right? So, like, anyone has a right. In fact, I'd encourage people to help poor people. That's awesome. But if you go, I'm going to put a gun to your head and steal your money to help poor people, then that's a problem, you know? And the problem with government from a libertarian point of view is just the violence. The libertarian is really just the philosophy of peace. But yeah, you're right. That is a common like criticism.
This is the definition, according to Webster's Dictionary, an extreme laissez-faire political philosophy advocating only minimal state intervention in the lives of citizens. So
I would completely reject that definition. Like, that's not how I would define myself as a libertarian at all. I would go with a more, what's like a Rothbardian, Ludwig von Mises kind of like definition of literally just believing in the non-initiation of force.
So I would, to me, I would also add that it's basically the assumption that government can't do anything better than the free market, and that once government...
Okay, let me just make this. There's like different strands of libertarianism. What I am would be a more like radical, I'm like a voluntarist. Like, I just believe in the right to self-defense. Like, I'm not a pacifist. Mm-hmm. Like, I think you can defend yourself with violence if violence is brought to you. But besides that, I think there's no reason to ever use violence except in self-defense. Like, that's the idea. Like, everything else is the non-initiation of force. Now, there's other libertarians who will come from it more like what you're saying, which is more of like the Chicago school, like Milton Friedman libertarians. They more come from it from like a practical point of view. They're like, the market is much more effective. So that's when you'll see things like what Lewis just read, like minimal state interference. But I'm not for minimal interference. I'm not for like, oh, well, just a 2% tax is okay. Like, taxation is theft, so no taxes. You know, that's more my take.
So you're almost describing like an anarchist type thing.
Yeah, that's more or less what it is. But it's a libertarian anarchist. It's like the idea that the principle that it's not against laws, or it's against rulers is the idea. You can have rules, but you can't have rulers. So everyone should be held. What should bind people together, or what should govern society, if you want to call it a government, is protecting people's freedoms. Protecting people have a right to protect other people's freedoms. We have a right to organize to protect other people's freedoms. And look, I'll the thing that hung me on to, like, oh, for years I was kind of like a minarchist, like rather than a complete like anarchist or voluntarist. The thing that held me on for years was like, well, we got to have at least like the state run X or Y, you know, like cops say, we got to have the state run cops because what about poor people? But then you realize that the thing that fucks over poor people the most are cops. You know what I mean? It's like everything that the government does in this, in the name of we need this for poor people, they end up fucking over poor people more than anyone else could imagine, you know? Like corporations would rip off poor people if the government didn't regulate them. Would they rip them off more than imprisoning more of them than anyone else in the world? Would they do, right. You know what I mean? Would they do worse than what the government's doing to them right now? I don't see it.
Now, I'm not sure if the Gomites followed that. Can we somehow put it into like the terms of rape?
Ha, blah, blah, ape. Blah, 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 monkey ape. Rah, rah, rah. She says no, take it anyway.
I'm just speaking on behalf of the fans. I
think
want
what
them
I'm trying to tell you guys is you can't rape, by the way. That's the, well,
all right, look, what do you do to the people that say libertarianism is a selfish way of governing? Because it's like,
what's selfish, man? I mean, what is, I've heard that criticism before, but what's selfish about me saying like, I want my rights and I want you to have your rights? Why wouldn't government be selfish? Why wouldn't saying like I should get something that someone else pays for being selfish?
Well, look,
why is my saying I'll take care of myself?
I agree with you for the most part. And we agree on a lot of things, you know, but at the end of the day, we do have a system of government in place. The government is intervening in every area and every aspect of our lives. You know what I'm saying? So I think that my only criticism of libertarianism from I guess your perspective is that we're not, you know, you're talking about these very specific issues. Yesterday we were discussing healthcare. You know, it's not a practical thing to go, all right, well, government hands off. It's just kind of this concept. It's like an idea that there's just nothing that we could actually even implement. So I think
I don't agree with you on that at all. I mean, and there's lots of things throughout history that you could have made that argument for that might have been plausible. Like you'd be like, well, every nation has been built on slavery, so we're not going to have a country not built on slavery. And no, then we just got rid of it, and actually it was fine. It worked out great, and we just found better ways of getting cotton. You know, it's like it's that simple. And no.
Is it better? I'm being honest though, like, were we more productive? Like,
no,
as society?
No, we were far more productive after we ended slavery. After we ended slavery, we literally figured out how to have machines pick the cotton. This is what happens. It's a big myth that like slavery or imperialism or violating people's rights produces wealth. It produces some immediate wealth for the slave owner, but it fucks the rest of us out of tons of wealth. Because when you have a free society, what happens is, if I have a gun and I point it to you, I go, you're my slave, pick cotton for me. You go, okay, so we got the productivity of the cotton out of this transaction. But if I don't have a gun and I go, I want you to pick cotton for me, you go, well, I'm going to need a salary. You go, now I got to produce something too. I got to produce money in order to get, you literally just doubled up your production by making it voluntary. It's and there's, by the way, I mean, just countless examples of this. Look at Hong Kong. They went from, they just created a free market there. They literally went from being mud huts to being like a city skyline in a couple decades. It's incredible what free markets can do. And there's a reason why America was the biggest free market ever and the wealthiest country of all time. But when you say things like, oh, the government regulates every aspect of our life, it's true. And we live in the age of huge government, and it is hard to imagine them ever being out. So I get what you're saying, but and my society, believe, we're a far way off from ever getting where I want us to be. But at the same time, like, look, no, we, up until 1913, there was no income tax in America, and we were the most prosperous country in the world. Now we have a huge income tax, but it's not impossible that one day we would not have it again. I mean, we did once not have it. Like, it's been done before, and it could be done again. And in terms of, like, no, look, have we ever not had an income tax and not been a horribly racist society? No. But maybe we could get that right one day. You know what I mean? Like, there's no, just because it hasn't been done doesn't mean we can't take the next step.
Another piece of information that might be helpful for this picture is Lewis is kind of looking and he's saying, hey, we got all these branches of government that are doing something. How can we exist without those branches of government? Right? That's kind of what you're saying.
I think what Lewis is saying is that it's not practical that they're ever going to go away.
Right, but
so they're here. Let's deal with it.
But here's what the insightful piece of information.
It's more of my philosophy in life, which is play your cards. You know what I'm saying? The cards that are on the table is that government does have their hands in everything from the food we eat to the TV that we watch to what we're looking at on the internet and every aspect. And it only seems to be getting.
Be a helpful piece of information is just how disruptive some of those government agencies are. So, for instance, you would have a philosophy about how the Fed, which you might people might think, hey, this is helpful in terms of regulation, has actually been quite disruptive. Or,
sure.
Or for instance, you or have a theory about the Department really of Education.
Well, all of them, a lot of it's built on dishonesty. A lot of it's built, like, we have, you know, what I would recommend to anyone, if you're interested at all in this conversation, to read. It's like a 60-page pamphlet. I think it's one of the most important works ever written, is Murray Rothbard, Anatomy of the State. And he more or less just breaks down what government is within 60 pages of this little pamphlet. It's an incredible read. And it's more, it's just like, look, this is what the state is. This is what they are not. This is kind of what they claim to be versus what they actually are. So he's just like, look, all these things like we are the government of the people, the this, the kind of idea that the government is the land, that it's this. What the government is are powerful people who have guns on their side and write orders for other people to follow. And they're kind of like a mob that just rules this area. I mean, and you can see that if you look at the reason they speak Spanish in South America is not because everyone decided to speak Spanish. It's because people from Spain fucking came over with guns and were like, you work for us now. Like, that's how government kind of happens. And the idea that, like what we were talking about earlier with the war on drugs, the Partnership for a Drug-Free America was funded by tobacco and alcohol companies. Government isn't just this thing that's, like, benevolent in the middle of society, like, let me watch out for you. It's people who have self-interests using the power structure to, you know, promote their own self-interests. That's more, and that's what the Federal Reserve is. That's people getting rich.
All right, I want to switch gears here for a minute, because we don't have a ton of time here on the Real S podcast today. We're talking to Dave Smith. Check out his podcast, Part of the Problem, on Stand Up New York Labs. Also check out his brand new web series, Dave Smith On, where he talks about everything from political to social issues in a nice, neat little package. It's Dave Smith's answer to a video blog. Really, really cool, man. Go check out the first one. The second one will actually be out already at this point. The first one was on arming Syrian rebels, which I want to talk about right now. The second one was on the war on drugs. But the first one we did, man, we shot this last week. And it's kind of funny because we watched it so many times. I was helping edit it down. I directed it. And it started to really make me look into what was going on over there. Because the truth of the matter is, dude, I watched another thing called New Yorkers On. As I'm doing, like, research for what we're doing with your thing, I'm noticing, you know, just other people are talking about these issues. And a lot of people just don't fucking really know what's going on. I didn't really know too much of what was going on. And it's kind of a scary thing.
Well, I'll tell you just a quick thing that John Stewart said the other day that I just really got a kick out of was he was reading the poll, and I forget exactly what the numbers were, but he was like something like, you know, now after all these beheadings, something like 65% of Americans approve bombing Syria, which is about 15% more than can locate Syria on a map. So that's like the situation you've got in America, is people just kind of without knowing anything, being okay with dropping bombs on human beings.
If you went out right now into the streets of New York City, I would guarantee you said, "Hey, look, have you been watching these beheadings on the media in the news? Yeah, what do you think that we should do to Iraq because of the beheadings? What do you think we should do? I think we should go to war right now." They don't even fucking know. They have no idea.
And when there's no draft, and when it's not you going there, it's just a very abstract thing. It's like, yeah, let's do it. But it is pretty crazy to me that you would just be okay with dropping bombs on human beings without, like, learning a little bit about it. Like, before I just, like, give the okay on murder, like, I want to know a few things about this case. But it is pretty kind of crazy. It's hard to get that much thought from people.
Kind of the moral story also of, hey, these people are beheading people, we got to go ahead and do something about it. So I read this article on National Review that kind of exposed that, firstly, Saudi Arabia, which is like an ally of ours,
yes,
they behead people all the time.
Yeah, I made that point in Dave Smith On.
And then secondly, the moderate Syrian rebels who were arming have beheaded more people in the last month than ISIS.
Yeah, see, that's the type of shit that they don't want you to hear. But
yeah,
it's ridiculous.
Part of the world are fucking look. Listen to me, dude. It's a part of the world where, I mean, they literally look up at the sky and believe that God is shining down upon them, and they are willing to die in the name of that.
That is some crazy ooga booga.
I'm writing on the walls in caves with my finger in mud. We're not fighting the same war as those people. It's an unwinnable thing. The only thing you can do is decimate these people or get the fuck out of there. So if we're not willing to just completely wipe out that part of the world, which I don't think we should do,
right,
What the fuck are we? Why are we trying to integrate our systems and our lifestyles?
Well, there's
in this
a lot
part
of shit
world
going on
where they don't fucking want it.
There's
at
a lot
all.
Of shit going on in the back well, end. There's a lot of money being made, and a lot of you know the way our entire economy is propped up now revolves around us dominating that part of the world. But no, you're absolutely right. I mean, this is it's craziness. It's craziness to think that we can spread our values around the world at the force of a gun. And yeah, like you said, it's pretty obvious. I mean, the more you just follow this stuff, that these guys are all full of shit. They're all full of shit. And there's big money being made behind the scenes. And the politicians they're kind of like the front men for these corporations who are making tons of money. So they just kind of like they'll say what they need to say to like sell you.
I would say
Vice just did a thing, and I watched it. They interviewed. It's a 20-something-year-old Somali-Canadian guy who went over to Syria, burnt his passport, and fucking, you know, joined forces with ISIS. And they did an interview with him, and they're basically, this guy's talking to him, and he was just kind of like, you know, give me some insight as to what's going on. And the kid said, he was like, look, we don't want to fight anybody. He was like, we may be doing, you know, we are attacking you, but we are only attacking you in retaliation for what you guys are doing to us. If you left us alone, if America would get their interests out of the Middle East and let us live under the law that we decide, Sharia law, which let's get into what specifically that is in a second. But if they would let us do that, we wouldn't give a fuck. We don't want to be near you. It's, you know, look, I'm not even being an asshole here, but the kid is kind of right.
He was wrong about a lot in the interview.
He's going to storm the White House and they're going to raise the ISIS flag over the White House.
And lots of other shit he was wrong about. He's a maniac. But yeah, I mean, it is like even these maniacs, it was a funny moment when he just does it. He's like, you know, we don't want to fight. If you guys would just stop fighting us, we'll stop fighting you. And you're just kind of like, oh, so there's a solution. There's an easy solution to all this. We could just mind our own fucking business. I mean, dude, I'm just saying, like, as I was saying before, I mean, we imprison more of our own population than anyone else in the world. We are having enough trouble just maintaining freedom here. We don't need to go, you know, the idea, it's so utopian to think that we're going to protect it everywhere. But yeah, we should just go. But we should just come home.
To play devil's advocate on that guy, Sharia law, I guess from the way I understand it, is fairly oppressive in that they do behead people and they do enforce very strict Muslim laws. That would almost be like if, you know,
Hitler was eradicating
the Jews and he's like, hey, this is my state, this is what we're doing, like, just let us do what we want to do here. So not that I think we should go over there and impose our will.
So the argument becomes what if people's rights are being violated in another country? What right do you have to go over there on behalf of those people and fight for them? And I'll tell you, I do believe in the right to self-defense, and I believe that you can export that right so someone else can come in and defend you. I think, like, if you see someone else being raped, you can defend that person. So I'm not saying you can't do that, but let's be real. When we're bombing these countries, that's not what we're doing. Bombs don't go in and become like protective shields over the good guys and over the bad guys. We kill a lot more people. We've killed far more innocent Iraqis than ISIS ever could. So let's just fucking get real here. There's a million dead Iraqis on our conscience. They've maybe got a few thousand. So I'm just saying, like, let's get real. We're not protecting people there. No, if that was really our outlook, like we just want to be humanitarians here and protect people, then absolutely, let's send ships with aid. With food and medical aid, like right up to the borders. Let's try to sneak people out and bring people to better countries. Absolutely. And you know what? If you wanted to say text 666-575 to support this fund voluntarily, you would raise millions of dollars from good people all over the world who do care about the plight of these people. You see that when there's an earthquake in Haiti, or was that a hurricane or an earthquake in Haiti? Whatever the fuck happened to Haiti. We all text. People do support. Like, people will do the right thing voluntarily. You know, I mean, at least to some degree. A lot better than the government.
I think it was just Haiti being Haiti.
Yeah.
How much of a threat do you think they really are to America? Because I'll tell you, my feeling, I genuinely think that we're going to be attacked in New York very soon. I have a feeling, I think where there's smoke, there's fire. I think obviously these guys are saying a lot of shit, but what I think, and the head of ISIS, I don't remember his name, but he had this weird, eerie, fucked up message where he was like, look, he was like, go and attack. He was like, don't think about it. Don't question it. Don't talk about it. Just attack. And it's just fucked. It's literally because he knows the guys, all these plans that have been uncovered over the past, you know, 13 years since 9/11, every plan that's been uncovered is because it's a plan. There's 20 people involved and they're trying to attack this on this large scale. But you know what? If they get two brothers, like the guys who did the Boston marathon bombing, who just have each other, confide in each other and get together and fucking do it, they can create a lot of damage.
Yeah, well, there's
and
no
I think you're
going
to see this beheading that happened in Oklahoma. I think you're going to see much more of that type of shit. And it's going to be small scale type stuff. But we are constantly walking around on eggshells in fear. And I think that that's what they're trying to do.
I don't think it's logical to constantly be walking around in fear, because the truth is when you're far, far more likely to like be killed in a car or like something like that than you are to be killed from terrorism. But look, I don't think you're completely wrong. I think if you look, 9/11 was blowback. That's what it was. I know a lot of people think it was an inside job. I know a lot of people think they hate us because we're free. I just think that's all wrong. It was blowback. It was very, very clearly blowback. We have been fucking with this part of the world for decades and decades. There's tons of examples of blowback. And we never look at what we did. We always look at Iran's a threat and Iran hates us. And then you got to go, do you know the history is that in the 50s, our CIA went into Iran and overthrew an elected government and imposed the Shah, who is a brutal dictator. So how would you feel, right, as a country, if someone had come in, overthrown your elected government, and put in a dictator who killed a bunch of your friends? You'd probably hate that part. Like, it makes sense. If you look at what bin Laden gave as the reasons for 9/11, it was us bombing the shit out of the Middle East, our support for Israel, and propping up, like, Saudi Arabian governments, our presence in the Arabian Peninsula. So, like, this is why they hate us. And what we've done since... So the thing that caused 9/11... or at least caused the anger for these primitive part of the world to develop these terrorists, was our bombing the Middle East, propping up dictators, and supporting Israel. Since 9/11, we haven't doubled down. We've quintupled down, 10 times down, on all of these policies. So yeah, in a lot of ways, I think we're more at risk than we've ever been for terrorists. Yeah, we're creating more of these guys than ever before. So and ISIS does seem like an even worse version of Al-Qaeda, which was a result of us funding the Mujahideen back in Afghanistan. Every time we do seem to create a worse and worse enemy. So I'm not saying there's nothing to fear, but don't let them use that fear to like get you cool with just doing the same thing over and over again.
I guess to add on to what Dave was saying, today in the news, they were talking about there was a lot of protest in Syria about our bombing because we killed like 2 dozen civilians and we started targeting.
Oh, they don't like that?
No, they don't like that. And then we also targeted a group that was Assad's the dude who's the head of Syria.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so one of the groups that was rebelling against Assad, we also targeted.
Yeah, because we don't know who the fuck we're fighting, who the fuck we're with, and who we're against over there.
To me, the dumbest part is, why don't we just let these people, like, let's say we wanted to have our own person in control over there, and I don't know, we wanted to impose our way of life. Why don't we just let these guys fight it out? We'll sit it out. Whoever wins, we'll just take that one guy.
Yeah, well, I mean,
it'll always be the next guy.
Right, well,
but
look,
at least then they'll be weakened because they had to fight it. Like, why do we have to get involved in
that?
We
want people who will make deals with us, who will play ball with us and, like, trade their dollars and their oil and dollars and a bunch of other shit like that. And so that's why we feel like we need to control who does it. But you can't, I mean, look, man, these are very primitive people. They're very, you know, these are pre-enlightened countries, let's just say, living in the dark ages. That's what a lot of these countries
are like.
It was
such a funny moment when the guy in the Vice interview,
the other guy comes over.
No, he's just talking about. He was like, "Are you guys under attack right now?" He was like, "We are always under attack. We are under attack 24 hours a day."
Why does he sound like Roy?
they don't know who that is. We are always under attack. You look up in the sky, I see the planes, and I welcome the attacks. I'm praying for the attacks. I'm praying for my death because I'm going to die a martyr, and I will see my God Allah. I will see the great Allah. What is it when we are beheading your people? Do you think they are praying for death? Do you think they are excited to see their Lord? No. And
that's the point where he's like, he's seen them. They're not ready to die. It was a very actually chilling point that he made. He said, he was like, I look in their eyes when they come up, when we have prisoners. He goes, they're not ready to die. My guys are ready to die. And it's true. It's a different type of thing. But look,
when
it's
you
a
really
different
believe that there's this fucking ghost in the sky that's going to high five you on the way up, it's just not
it's
that
not
bad. They
that.
Really believe
it's
that.
It's not just that. It's the ghost in the sky. It's like the religious thing, but it's also the fact of when you've seen your family members torn apart by these drone strikes or something like that. You know, look, you can't. Even though they are primitive and unenlightened, you can't look past the fact that it's like there's, look, man, the philosophy of drone strikes is kind of like, this is the example I use. It's like, let's say like in Chicago, okay, You know, and Lewis, you're a parent, so you can kind of almost try to relate to this type of thing. But let's say in Chicago, there were a few murderers who were out on the lam. They were fugitives, like the cops were looking for these murderers. And they ran into a school and held up the school hostage. So it's like we've got these two suspected murderers held up in a school and they're holding people hostage. And the police department went, okay, no problem. We're going to blow up the school. And you go, you know, we'll kill like all the kids and the teachers and the stuff, but we'll get the murderers. They'll be gotten. Is like, I think people might have a problem with that. People are like, what? Wait, what? No, well, obviously that's not an option. I mean, the whole point of having a law enforcement is that you're trying to not kill those kids. But that is the philosophy of drone strikes. That's how we operate. We go, oh, we've got a couple suspected bad guys. Take out whoever's in the... Oh, they're at a cafe? Take out the cafe. They're at a wedding? Take out the fucking wedding. I mean, this is what we do. These people, there's a reason why they're ready to die in a way that we're not ready to die. We haven't been through that shit. That hasn't been happening to us.
I do think a very, very big part of it is them believing that they're going to high five the ghost in the sky as well. I mean, they really,
yeah,
really,
but that's the
really,
place. Yeah, but dude, after you've been to all that, that's the place the human psyche
look,
goes.
The guys,
no,
look,
dude,
I also think
there's religious people all over the world, Lewis. Religious people who are backward all over the world. The ones who were not bombing don't come to try to don't launch a jihad against us. There's no just fucking click
no,
tribe
I'm just
in the middle of Central
about
Africa
them being willing to die and their willingness to
yes,
die
that
and
plays
the
a
type
big part
of
in it.
The type of fight that we're in.
I
with
can't
them.
Deny the religiosity of the terrorists. Yes, obviously that is a truth, but. There is no, I mean, the correlation between suicide bombing and religion is not very strong. The correlation between suicide bombing and places that we're oppressing is very strong.
All right, let's go to the fans. I asked the Gomites to chime in. Very excited, very engaged, the Gomites, with Dave Smith being on the show.
They're my only fans, too.
It's also Smarmy the Smarmy Army.
The Smarmy Army out there. Lionheart wants to know if you've ever considered dating an obese man. This is for a friend of his. Dave, ever consider dating an obese man?
You already fucked Lewis. What's the big deal?
Lewis was in shape when I fucked him. I've never really considered it until this moment right now. But what do you bring to the table? You make decent money or something? Like, what are you bringing to the table?
Wait a minute. You know, this is very weird. I don't know if somebody's making a joke. Because I guess in the last Legion of Skanks, we talked about you not getting a tattoo because of your religious beliefs. But it's kind of funny that Robbie's here for this. Because somebody said, what other crazy adventures has your religious beliefs held you back from?
Oh, he's being sarcastic, though.
And are you allowed to touch microphones on Fridays?
Yeah, I think that's
so,
a joke.
He's being sarcastic. But ask Robbie, what other things haven't you been able to do because of your religious beliefs? Actually, Robbie, let me ask you this. Give me one example of a time that you really wish that you weren't religious, that you could have taken part in something that you could not do because of your religion. Oof. You guys don't know Robbie Bernstein
is
a practicing Jew.
Well, I would say,
TGIF, he never got to experience Urkel.
I would say the crazy things are like, I mean, I've never eaten like seafood, I've never had meat and cheese, I've never had pork, which kind of strikes people as crazy. But I would say the biggest nuisance for me, I've never really dated or had a girlfriend because it would be uncomfortable to kind of, like, I guess take, like, a chick home. So I would say that's kind of the biggest hindrance.
Your religion has made you not been able to take a chick home? What do you mean?
In a way.
You can't just be, like, fucking someone. You'd have to be like, are you guys getting married?
Yeah, exactly.
Or what's
it would have to be,
on?
Like, a pretty formal ordeal
okay.
if it was to be part of my family life. And so it... You know,
Orthodox, you're not even Orthodox, but like religious Jews.
All of my friends I grew up with, they're all married.
So you couldn't just date a Jew, even a Jewish girl. You couldn't just go on a date with a Jewish girl. That's
no, it's
religious.
Not, he's not saying that he couldn't go on a date. He's just saying the pressure would be like, well, are you marrying her? Are you doing this?
It would be very much married. The whole like universe is very much marriage geared, which I'm not kind of wired up for. And then it gets uncomfortable like if, you know, you start dating seriously someone who you wouldn't really want to marry. It's uncomfortable.
I get what my mom was saying about you guys. I'm going to be honest.
Yeah, I get it. I don't like us either. So me and your mom are on the same page.
It's a little annoying.
I don't know if that
Michael
was
Ruddy wants to know, what do you think about companies like Burger King leaving the United States to avoid taxes and shit?
I've, you know, yeah. So then cut taxes. I mean, like, that's, yeah, look, if businesses aren't, are going to go where there's a more friendly environment to do business, that's them. That's like, it's like, it's very easy to look at someone else and be like, oh, those greedy, unpatriotic, that. It's like, would you leave a job to go to a job that paid you more? Quite possibly. That's the way it works. Stop stealing their money. Let them create here.
So wait, Burger King moved the company to Canada?
I don't know exactly what they did. They moved a lot of their shit over there, or a lot of their, like...
I think they pulled the same move Dunkin' Donuts did, which was they bought a company in Burger King so that they could move the headquarters there and be taxed as a Canadian company.
Why do we own Burger King? Why do we own the rights to that? You know, the whole reason why America is America...
Yeah, more power to him. He's playing the game.
Yeah, the whole reason The reason why America is America is, right, was that we were, like, the land of the free or whatever, is, like, the people... You could come here and be free, so, like, you wouldn't be oppressed, and that's why we got all the good people from other countries. So if there's more freedom somewhere else, why shouldn't they get some of the good shit from us? Huh?
Yeah,
I mean, we're made up of stolen from Europe, right?
I have no problem with somebody looking for a financial loophole. I think that is the essence of America.
Well, the idea that you're ever going
to... Being able to go out and prosper and to make as much money as possible, run your business the way that you want to run your business, and if you find an opportunity to save money and to create more of a comfortable life for your family, more fucking power to you.
Well, truthfully, from the way I look at it, it's like you go out there and you create, which is what this is all about. The reason why we don't just live in the forest and we're not dying from an infected fucking toe is because people go out and create. You go out, you create jobs, you create wealth, you create a product someone else wants, and then the fact that the government's going to come steal any of your money is kind of disgusting. So if you can avoid or go to a place where less of it will get stolen, good for you. Although Burger King doesn't make a great product.
Chris Trainer wants to know, who's your favorite libertarian TV or movie characters?
TV or movie characters? I mean, that's kind of a tough one. Like, you're saying characters, so fictional.
Are they
really represented? Or the,
all
is the libertarian...
of the media, the thing is that all of the media is so geared toward either being like pro-military or pro-state or something like that. I would say, whew, man, that's a tough one. I got to think about that for a second.
Well, who would,
like,
let's
V
say,
for Vendetta is like what's coming to my mind right now.
Before libertarianism, though, I mean, Archie Bunker. Archie Bunker would have kind of been a libertarian. No,
Archie Bunker to me was more of a, like, you know, he's a traditionalist kind of like guy. I don't know if that's really about libertarianism. I mean, I would. Whew. Jesus, I'm really trying to kind of run through. I don't know, man. That's a good question, dude. I got to think about that a little bit. I mean, like, look, there's great, like, works of fiction, like, you know, Atlas Shrugged, 1984, V for Vendetta, I thought was really great. I think there's kind of, like, the spirit of House of Cards is kind of a hero, but I don't know who the hero is exactly. You know what I mean? So I don't know. That's a good, excellent question, though. I got to think about that.
All right. Look, we're going to wrap up here in a second. Dave Smith, where can the fans find you? We've plugged a bunch of your shit so far, but how can the fans find you?
You find me in this room way too much. Yeah, man, fucking check out the web series, Dave Smith On. Check out my podcast, Part of the Problem, on the same network, Stand Up NY Labs. Yeah, man, you know, Hammerfist and Legion of Skanks, all that shit.
Yeah, follow Dave Smith on Twitter, at Comic Dave Smith as well. Guys, go check out the new web series. I'm directing every single weekend and helping Dave produce it. Anything else to plug? Any live shows come up? Anything cool, Dave?
Fuck, man. What do we got coming up? I don't know. You want
to
plug
a live
that
Legion
Chance,
of
the Chance
show.
Theater?
You know, I'll do the close music here. Guys, follow Rob, you don't have any social media, right?
No. You can check me out at CheckSpots.LOL, or I'm probably hanging out wherever Dave and Lewis are loitering around. I'll be in a corner, not actually performing, just being there, kind of staring at the floor. So
kind of making things awkward with whoever the booker is.
Feel free to say hello. I'll probably be drinking and just being a weirdo.
All right, guys, go follow me on Twitter at Lewis J. Gomez. Me, Dave Smith, and Big J, live Legion of Snacks, November 14th from The Chance in Poughkeepsie. Also, this Wednesday, tomorrow night, or tonight, I'll be headlining comics at Foxwoods in Connecticut. So come out. Peace.
Fuck you! That's all, folks.